Interval.
Chapter 21. In Old Norse mythology, Valhalla was where slain Viking warriors went for their heavenly reward. In Westchester County, it was where pre-trial detainees went when they couldn't post bail. That was where I went, in a prison transport van. It had a latticework of steel bars behind the driver's seat, and the acrid odor of urine everywhere. It might have been an animal control van, except for the metal posts in the floor that my leg irons were shackled to. The cold seeped up from the steel floor and spread frigid fingers up my torso and down each coatless arm. Through the windshield, I could see the slant of snow falling through the beams of the headlights. Valhalla was for warriors, and that was what I had to become. Roger and Tommy had been in and out of jail throughout my childhood, and they liked to scare me with tales of kidney punches and toothbrushes sharpened into shivs. They delighted in teaching me about sodomy and wolf packs. So from the moment I realized I was actually going to jail, I started to prepare my game face. It was just like Mrs. Casco taught me. Put on the face you want the world to see. I wanted to be seen as a warrior, and I practiced it on the drive to Valhalla, galvanizing my eyes into a hot stare, clenching my jaw into a snarling grimace, staring at my fellow transport prisoners with a look that said, "Go ahead, I dare you." But they weren't looking at me. Three of them were huddled together and whispering in a language I didn't know. Hookers, I guessed, though not the happy variety, if there was such a thing. My fourth fellow prisoner was a white girl, trembling so violently her teeth clicked, from fear, the cold, or the drugs she'd ingested. Take your pick. Upon arrival at the women's unit, we were led shuffling into a holding cell, where the white girl promptly vomited onto the concrete floor and started to cry for her mother. Successfully, as it turned out. In less than 30 minutes, a guard arrived to take her to her parents. Her bail had been posted. The three Asian women were soon taken away, too. I was left behind with the puddle of vomit. An hour later, I was processed, a term that made me think of packaged meat. I underwent a cursory medical exam. Stick out your tongue, say ah, hold this thermometer in your mouth until we finally remember to take it out 10 minutes later. This was followed by a less cursory strip search. I used to laugh when my personal trainer used the term prisoner squat, but that was when I was wearing Lululemon leggings. It wasn't so funny when I was wearing nothing. A shower came next, and I was glad for it after a long day in the office and a second long day in the police station. They gave me a scrap of a towel to dry myself with, but no comb and certainly no blow dryer. My hair was going to dry in tangles. I'd look like Medusa. But maybe that was a good thing. One more mark of the warrior. I waited with the scant covering of the towel clasped around me while a clerk eyeballed me for size. She issued me a white cotton bra and panties, a set of orange scrubs, a pair of canvas sneakers, and a white t-shirt and blue pants for pajamas. I changed as directed into the underwear and scrubs, and they bagged the clothes I'd been wearing. They bagged my wedding ring, too. I didn't have any other personal property to be checked. My coat and purse and briefcase were still being held by the police as evidence. I was assigned an inmate number, fingerprinted and photographed, then led to another clerk who peck-typed my data into a computer and had to backspace with a sigh at regular intervals. Full legal name, address, birth date, contact person? I hesitated before I named David Lambert, same address. But when I couldn't provide a telephone number for him, the clerk heaved another sigh and backspaced to delete his name. I watched it disappear across the screen, letter by letter, until he was wiped from my profile. I didn't have any money to deposit into my commissary account, a deficiency that made the clerk sigh yet again. Then it was time for my allotted phone call, my single chance to find someone to post my bail. Who could I call? Not my mother. Not only was she broke, she was the one who'd landed me here. Not any of my old friends. I'd ghosted them years ago, so they wouldn't know how far I'd fallen. Imagine if they could see me now. And certainly not Mrs. Casco. She might never recover from the shock and disappointment of learning how her brightest hope had turned out. No, there's no one, I told the clerk. A guard arrived, a middle-aged woman, stout, with a warrior face at least as impressive as mine. She led me into Pod C in the women's unit, past a long corridor of cells on either side. They had a gridwork of steel bars and doors that slid open and closed, and two bunks in each, top and bottom, all currently unoccupied. I followed the guard in a zombie walk, with my arms stretched out in front of me, heaped high with sheets, a blanket, a pillow, the rest of my prison clothes. The guard spoke over her shoulder as we walked, biting out the rules and the daily schedule. Roll call at 6 a.m., breakfast, then work. Everyone was required to work, in the kitchen, the laundry, or one of the prison industries. Then lunch, yard time, another roll call, and back to work until dinner. She stopped beside a cell, and when she stood aside and glared at me, I knew this must be where I got off. All day I'd been wondering where I would sleep tonight, and here was my answer. This cell was my new home. Cell, I thought as I stepped inside. Why did they call them cells? They should call them what they were. Cages. Lights out in 30, she said. You can stay here or go to the common room till then. I stayed where I was. I didn't know where the common room was, and I wasn't ready to make my prison debut just yet. I let my face relax as the guard left, and I turned a slow revolution to take in the tiny room. It had two metal bunks, cantilevered on the wall, like a pair of oversized steel bookshelves. Cantilevered on the opposite wall was a smaller metal slab, this one serving as a desk, with an attached metal chair. Mounted to the end wall were a stainless steel toilet and sink. Neither bunk was made up, and there were no papers on the desk, no photos or other signs of habitation. It gave me hope that I'd be spared a roommate, or rather, a cellmate. No, a cellie. I needed to learn the lingo. I made up the lower bunk with the rough weave sheets and a pilled blanket. When I stretched out on the bed, I realized it was the first time I'd been horizontal since early Sunday morning. I tried not to think about the bedbugs and bodily fluids that might reside in the lumpy mattress. I tried to relax and let my muscles sink into the bed. But I could feel the metal slab under me. It was the proverbial pea, and I was the proverbial princess. Hot tears pooled in my eyes. I'd felt like a princess once, in my sparkling tower apartment with my handsome husband prince. And now, here I was, in prison, charged with murder. I shivered with the cold and tugged the blanket up to my chin. The hard metal bunk wasn't a pea. It was more like a mortuary slab. They've killed me, I thought, and tears of self-pity streaked down my face. Or I'd killed myself. Because really, I did this to myself. My mother's dead. I'm an only child. My husband works nights. They were stupid lies, easily exposed. If only those hadn't been the cops' first questions out of the box. I wasn't ready for them yet, penned up in that little room off the lobby with the gun blast still bouncing around inside my skull. Denying my family was simply a reflex, as involuntary as breathing. I hadn't been thinking like a suspect yet. I hadn't foreseen the landmines awaiting me. Then there were my job hunting lies, the Innocence Project, the software program, harmless embellishments invented solely to get through an interview. But they'd backfired on me too. Now my credibility was shot. The cops would never believe what really happened. No, My family did this to me. They'd been dragging me down all my life, and here they were doing it again. Barb and her big mouth. Roger and his stupid gun-making business. You tell me, Miss Fancy Pants Lawyer, Barb had said during my idiotic Christmas Day call. How come it's legal to buy the kits and legal to make the guns, but not legal to sell them? What about the Second Amendment, huh? Sure, Mom, I'd answered. The Constitution definitely guarantees the right to keep and sell arms. I remembered Mrs. Casco driving me home after debate practice one day when I was about 13. And there they were, Barb and Roger and Tom, all of them splayed on the front stoop with beer cans in their hands. My brothers shirtless and paunchy and tattooed. My mother with her trademark orange smear of lipstick and a kaleidoscope of changing hair color. I froze in the passenger seat as tears of shame flooded my eyes. Forget them, Mrs. Casco had said. They're nothing to you, less than nothing. In no time, you'll be far from here, living your own life your own way, and it'll be like they never existed. It worked for a time, for a long time. Certainly David never doubted I was all alone in the world. It would have worked still if they hadn't found my birth certificate or tracked down Barb through my phone. Once they found her, it was all over. She couldn't keep her mouth shut about anything. But there was no point in blaming this on my family. Seeking revenge against them would be as pointless as suing a homeless person. It would gain me nothing. I had a far better target for my revenge. J. Ingram Barrett, Jr. He was the one who really did this to me. And if I figured out how to bring him down, it could gain me everything. I had a lot of nights ahead to work out how I'd do it. I scrubbed away my tears. Enough of that. I had to be a warrior, not a princess. A princess would spend this time wallowing in self-pity, but a warrior would be planning her attack, or in my case, my defense. Vengeance would come later, after exoneration. A loud buzzer sounded, and the corridors of Pod C suddenly swelled with a cacophony of shouts and cries and laughs and grunts. My fellow detainees were being herded back to their cells before lights out. I lay very still on my bottom bunk, hoping they wouldn't notice me as they streamed past the open door of my cell. Their voices were guttural and their language foul. "Who the fuck dat?" I heard someone say, and I braced myself. But no one ventured in. The clamor died down a bit. Someone started to sing, and someone else roared for her to shut the fuck up. Then the cage doors shut with a booming clash of steel, up and down the corridor. A minute later, everything went dark. The night sounds in Pod C were softer, sobbing, snoring, and sex sounds. And in my cell, a different sound that only I could hear. The hum of the wheels turning inside my brain as I worked through what I was going to do next. Exoneration first, then revenge. I made my prison debut in the morning after roll call when the doors clanged open up and down the block. The women swarmed out of their cells, voices buzzing loudly as they made their way to breakfast. Theirs were a sea of brown faces, African Americans and Latinas. Not a white face to be seen. And I realized why. White women made bail. I let them pass before I stepped out and joined the end of the line, crowding into the cafeteria. I kept my face a tight mask, tamping down every reflex to smile or show interest or any other emotion. Supreme boredom was the look I was aiming for in repose. But when some of the women turned and stared at me, I ramped it up to that face I'd practiced in the prison transport van. Fierce, fearsome, a force to be reckoned with. The cafeteria, or mess hall, the barracks term was probably more accurate, was a long, low-ceilinged room with regimented rows of metal tables and clamped-on metal chairs. Raised voices bounced off the concrete floor and boomeranged through the metal furniture until the decibel level was high enough to rival a Tribeca dance club. I went through the line and loaded up my tray with dry yellow lumps of scrambled eggs, sausage patties floating in a pool of grease, and fruit cocktail out of a can. Then I looked around for a place to sit. There were no empty tables, but I spotted a table with two empty seats at the end, and I took one of them. There were four other women at the table, and they all stopped eating to stare at me. I resumed my look of bored indifference and shoveled the lump of egg into my mouth. The woman at the far end of the table suddenly leaned around the woman beside her and stabbed a fork in my direction. The three other women stopped eating to watch. The fork was plastic and didn't concern me, but the woman holding it did. She was small and dark, Latina, with a purple bandana over her hair, and a hard, wiry body coiled tight with energy. Even if I hadn't noticed the deference shown to her by the other women, it was obvious to me that this one was the alpha female. "What are you?" she demanded, fork pointed like a laser. Later, I would learn that was a routine question, meaning what are you in for? Drugs, hooking, who'd you kill, or what'd you steal? But I didn't know that yet. I still defined myself by my job, not my crime. "I'm a lawyer," I said, with my eyes narrowed and my tone brutal. I said it like I was saying killer. Like being a lawyer was my crime, and a pretty heinous one at that. A rumble of murmurs rolled around the table, then spread to the next table and the table beyond that one. Dozens of women twisted in their seats to gape at me. But they didn't look hostile. They had a gleam of interest in their eyes. I thought they must be struck by the novelty of seeing a lawyer on this side of the bars. Penitentiaries were full of lawyers serving hard time, but I doubted there were any here in pre-trial detention, for the obvious reason that lawyers could post bail or had friends who could post it for them. As both a lawyer and a white woman, I had no business being here at all. But as it turned out, it wasn't the novelty that drew their interest. It was my potential usefulness. The women surged out of their seats and swarmed around me, buzzing with questions. "How long till they have to give me a trial? Don't they have to let me go if my boyfriend says he did it, not me? Don't my mom have to bring my kids to see me?" They must have all had lawyers on the outside, but public defenders were notoriously overworked and underpaid and stingy with their time. A lawyer on the inside would be a real asset. They pressed in close, jostling one another to gain my ear, calling out their questions from all sides. I had to clap my hands over my ears to close out the clamor. "I can't hear when you're all talking at once," I shouted. The bandana-wearing alpha woman put two fingers in her mouth and blew a sharp whistle. Instantly, everyone fell silent. "Back the fuck off," she shouted. She stabbed her fork at me again. "You know any of this shit?" she said. "You ain't no real estate lawyer or nothing." I took a bite of sausage, chewed and swallowed. "I know all of this shit," I said. The woman's chin came up and her eyes narrowed. Her name was Nina, I soon learned, and she ran Pod C. She ordered everyone back to their tables and announced that the lawyer would take their questions one at a time, by appointment only, beginning in the common room that evening. She, Nina, would be in charge of the appointment book. "How much time for each?" she asked me. "Depends on the question." Nina shook her head. "No, we gotta do this orderly-like." "Then make it 15-minute slots." "Okay, bitches," she hollered. "See me if you want an appointment." The other women seemed to know enough not to clamor around Nina. They formed a line and waited patiently until she finished her breakfast and waved the first one forward. She wrote that woman's name on her napkin, then waved the next one forward. I finished my own breakfast and mentally reviewed everything I knew about pretrial criminal procedure. I'd never actually been employed by the Innocence Project, of course, but I'd put in enough volunteer hours there to pick up a working knowledge of criminal law. enough hours that the local office director was willing to let me claim it as employment on my resume. Anyway, you didn't need to know the answers to be a good lawyer. You only needed to know which questions to ask. I had this. It hit me then. I didn't have to pretend to be a warrior to survive here in Valhalla, because a lawyer was a warrior. A bell clanged at the end of breakfast, and the inmates filed off to their assigned jobs in the kitchen or the laundry or the workshop. A guard stood at the door scanning the crowd. Not a guard, I reminded myself, a CO. His eyes landed on me, and he crooked a finger.
You, he shouted, come with me.
He was a white man with a scrawny neck and an Adam's apple that protruded like a tumescent organ. I got up and followed him uneasily. He took me by the elbow, bony fingers digging in, and led me out of Pod C and down a long corridor. He stopped at an unmarked door. A broom closet? I wondered. And I wondered next if this would be my introduction to prison rape. I looked him up and down. I was pretty sure I could take him in a fight. He opened the door. It wasn't a darkened broom closet. It was a small office under the glare of fluorescent tubes in the ceiling. Three women in street clothes sat at three of the four metal desks. One of them was on the phone, and the other two were peering at the screens of their last-generation computers. Against one wall was a bank of gray metal filing cabinets.
Here she is,
the CO announced. The woman on the phone clapped her hand over the mouthpiece. Can you type? Yes, I said, startled.
Then sit there.
She pointed to the empty desk. The CO left, and I sat down. It seemed that my work assignment was to assist these clerical employees with typing and filing and photocopying. While the other inmates did the dirty work of the jail, I would spend my days here, in a comfortable chair, in a clean office, with the thermostat set to a balmy 72 degrees. My white woman privilege might have been useless when it came to raising bail, but I knew it was the only reason I'd landed this plum work assignment. It turned out that jail was a business, with business records to process. It issued purchase orders and received invoices and maintained inventories of supplies, just like any other business. And because the jail workshops made products for sale, there were also finished goods inventories and shipping documents and records of the payments remitted to the county. There was the prisoner payroll, too, such as it was, at an average wage of 45 cents an hour. My own wages were set at 62 cents an hour, a nod to my superior skill set. It meant almost $5 would be credited to my commissary account at the end of the day. Enough, I hoped, to buy a toothbrush. The next day might even earn me a comb. We broke for lunch. That was followed by exercise time in the yard. I'd been issued a polyester blend coat, but no boots, and the snow was 6 inches deep outside. I huddled against the wall and stamped my feet and tried not to inhale the periwinkle clouds of tobacco smoke that drifted through the yard. Then it was back to the office for my afternoon shift, where I was able to dazzle my bosses with a few functions they'd never mastered on Excel. Then a dinner of meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and canned peas. It was bland, but hot and filling. I'd had three hot meals today, something I rarely experienced outside. I spent the evening in the common room. It was a space set up for cards and checkers at steel tables, with four attached seats each. It struck me that throughout the criminal justice system, all the way from Interview A to here in Valhalla, the chairs were always bolted to the tables. I'd never thought of using a chair as a weapon, but obviously someone had. One of the tables was reserved for me, with a pen and legal pad already set out. Nina pointed me to my seat, called out a name, and a young black woman hurried into the opposite seat. She was the first of the eight clients I advised over the course of the evening. Once, I never would have dispensed legal advice this way. Whenever friends or strangers tried to wrest an opinion out of me at the gym or a cocktail party, I'd tell them to make an appointment and sign a retention letter, and I'd be happy to answer their questions. It had been drummed into me at Jackson Reader's never to give advice or receive confidences, except in the context of an acknowledged attorney-client relationship. It wasn't just to assure a fee. It was for self-protection. Otherwise, any off-the-cuff remark could be construed as legal advice and form the basis of a malpractice suit, even when given for free. Destitution had released me from such constraints. Nobody would bother to sue me now. So I listened to their stories, gleaned the gist of their problems, and gave them a 5-minute answer and a list of issues to raise with their public defenders during their next sessions. There was a depressing sameness to all of the women's stories, whether they were in for solicitation or possession with intent or larceny or even drunk driving. There was always a man somewhere behind it, a husband or boyfriend who put her out on the street or who gave her a package to deliver, or who enlisted her to make a straw purchase of a gun or to drive the getaway car. It was their men who dragged them down every single time. In a world without men, none of these women would be here. My last appointment was with a pregnant 19-year-old who had 2 children now in foster care. She wanted conjugal visits with their father, and she didn't like the answer I gave her. Addicted to love, I thought, as her face twisted into a snarl and she lunged at me across the table. Nina got between us and the girl backed down. I didn't even know what her crime was, but it seemed clear there was a man at the root of it, just as with all the others. At the end of the night, the bell clanged in a signal to return to the cells. I snatched up the pen and paper and joined the line shuffling out of the common room. After an evening of hearing their stories, I felt like one of them. I might be the only white face among them, for sure the only one with a graduate degree. But I'd been dragged down by the men in my life too, just as they had. In a world without David, Roger, and most of all, Ingram Barrett, I wouldn't be here either. I occupied the rest of my march to Pod C, visualizing a world without Barrett. But exoneration before revenge. I needed to write to David and get to the bottom of exactly what he'd done to land me here. In the early days, we wrote to each other all the time. It was just a silly lover's game, since we were living together and saw each other morning and night. But there was something so thrilling about opening my briefcase at the office and finding a handwritten letter from David tucked inside, an ode to our lovemaking the night before, or a paean to my body, using terms that would be vulgar in the hands of a lesser writer. But David had the same way with words that he had with my body. I'd read his letter again during lunch and again on my evening commute, and by the time I got home, I'd be hot for him all over again. When did he write the last of those letters? I tried to remember. Probably September 15th, 2008, the day the world ended. And when did I write the last of my own letters to him? Probably a year later, when I found one unopened in the trash and realized there was no point in continuing. I reached my cell and stopped short. Someone else was there, up on the top bunk, tugging a sheet into place. All I could see of her was her upturned backside in the orange scrubs. Then she leapt to the floor and stuck her landing like a gymnast. "Oh, hi," she said as she turned. She was tiny, Chinese, I thought, with long black hair held up in a high pony. She'd tied a knot in the hem of her scrubs shirt so that it hugged her ribcage and gave a glimpse of her navel. She could have been 13 or 30. She looked like a teenage pop star. "I think you my Sally," she said. "I'm Shay. My name Jingjing." I took a seat at the desk and picked up the pen. I had 15 minutes before lights out. "Dear David," I wrote, "you may have heard. I no criminal," the girl said. "Me neither. About what happened in the elevator. I mean, I not charged with anything. I a material witness.
Oh?
That was interesting. I looked up from the page. Here was one more white woman privilege for me to enjoy. A Selly who was merely a witness.
Witness to what?
Jing Jing spoke her next words carefully, as if from a script, and with barely a trace of an accent. International sex trafficking. My only visitor was my court-appointed public defender, Harold Watkins. He was 40-something, seriously overweight, and perpetually short of breath. He was more experienced than the PDs assigned to most of my fellow inmates. A murder charge warranted a more senior defender. But since it was only second-degree murder, I suspected he was only a second stringer. In any event, I found him wanting, especially when he began every visit by pushing the idea of a plea. I didn't want to face trial, he warned me. The DA might knock the charge down to manslaughter, he thought. I stopped him cold. No deal, I said, and handed him a typewritten page. By that time, I'd earned enough goodwill from my work supervisors that I was allowed the use of the office equipment, and I'd used it to prepare a list of assignments for Watkins. The law entitled me to the government-paid assistance of counsel, and I intended to fully avail myself of it. I'd come a long way from the 25-year-old who had too much pride to apply for unemployment benefits. Watkins skimmed the page and looked up with a frown.
Hire a forensic video expert?
They've doctored that surveillance video, I know it. An expert can prove it.
Maybe, for a fee, a hefty fee.
Yes, you need to petition the court for expert funding. I handed him a motion I'd already drafted to that effect. He skimmed those pages.
This is a real long shot.
No harm in asking, and no skin off your back since I've done all the work. He scowled in a way that made me suspect I was his least favorite client. I didn't care. I wasn't out to make friends, only to influence people. Specifically, I hoped to influence the assigned prosecutor, an ADA named Max Harper. Watkins was right that I didn't want to go to trial. I was counting on the charges being dropped long before that. I was dropping breadcrumbs and counting on Harper to follow them. Watkins was still running down the assignment list.
A deposition of your brother?
He said, wheezing with the effort of speech.
In Leavenworth, Kansas.
He'll testify that he never sold or gave me a gun.
Of course he will. Nobody would expect otherwise. Of your brother or a convicted felon.
He took his pen and drew a line through that task.
A trip to Kansas? That is skin off my back.
My mouth tightened, but I moved on to the next item on my list. The release of my briefcase from evidence. His brow furrowed in deep, fleshy folds.
How come? What's in it?
Confidential company documents.
Saying what?
Sorry, privileged.
You don't even work for that company anymore.
I shrugged.
Besides, you'll get your briefcase back at the end of the case.
I want you to file a motion now.
Why?
To get their attention. He chuffed a laugh. It sounded like a gasp for breath.
I think you got it.
I want to redirect it. He gave me a long look.
I wish I knew what you're not telling me.
It's nothing you need to know. I moved on to the last item on my list. Interview David. I'd written to him several times by then, but I'd heard nothing back. In lieu of an actual marital conversation, I needed my PD proxy to talk to him.
We already tried that, Watkins said. A couple times. Nobody's ever home.
Try again, I said, and stood to adjourn the meeting. Watkins sighed, or maybe he just breathed hard as he heaved himself out of his chair. When he was gone, I shifted over to the next table in the attorney visiting room, where Jing Jing was awaiting her own visitor. Hers wasn't a defense lawyer, though. Hers was an assistant from the DA's office, who came regularly to talk to her and the other rescued sex workers about their anticipated testimony at the traffickers' trials. During her second meeting, she introduced me as her lawyer and insisted I be present at every interview. This is highly irregular, the ADA complained, but she let me stay. Jingjing was walking a tightrope with the DA's office. She needed to feed them enough information that they would continue to see her as a potential witness and keep the protective custody arrangement intact, but not so much information that her pimps would be able to figure out where it was coming from. Today, the ADA had a photo array for Jingjing to peruse. It included mugshots of dozens of men, both pimps and johns. She wanted Jingjing to pick out the ones she recognized. This is hard job, Jingjing said, as she turned the plastic-sleeved pages. You told us you saw the boss men every day. You must know what they look like. You know, get it. White people all look same to me. The ADA rolled her eyes while I hid my smile. Wait. Jingjing suddenly pounced on one of the photos. I know this man. I know him real good. The ADA spun the photo array back around to see where Jingjing was pointing and looked up with an excited gleam in her eyes. Really? You can definitely identify this one. Sure can. Jingjing leaned back and folded her arms across her chest. I see all his movies. The photo was of Luke Rafferty, the full-time actor, sometime John. After the ADA packed up and left, Jingjing and I walked to the commissary. The ADA topped up her account at every visit, and Jingjing always made a beeline to spend it. She laughed about it as we shared a bag of chips on our way back to our cell. They think they do awful thing to keep me here, she said, but it way more awful out there. For the last 8 years, she'd slept on the floor in a back room of whatever massage parlor she was working that month. She'd boiled water in a microwave and stirred in rice and dry soup mix for her meals. Here, I got mattress and good food, and no gross men. She beamed a smile. And a new bestie. Sometimes, I almost felt the same way. In Valhalla, I slept warm and enjoyed hot showers and a full belly every day. I got to exercise in the gym for free. Thanks to Nina and our legal aid clinic, I was in no danger from the other inmates, and I had a pleasant celly. We'd become constant companions over the past month. More than that, friends. The first one I'd made in over 5 years. The only real complaint I had about my current situation was the confinement. That didn't bother Jingjing. She hadn't been free in her outside life either, and her only alternative, according to the DA, was an ICE detention center, then deportation. She declared she'd rather spend the rest of her life in Valhalla than go back to her village in Yunnan. She didn't know whether her family was still there, nor did she care. They were the ones who'd sold her to the slavers in the first place. Her only real complaint was boredom. Because she was in custody as a material witness and not as a pretrial detainee, she was excused from the work requirements imposed on the other inmates. Without a work assignment, and with me in the office most of the day, she didn't know what to do with herself. There were three other victim workers housed in the women's unit, pursuant to the same material witness orders, and they were also excused from work. But Jingjing wanted nothing to do with them. They Malay, she sniffed. She ate with me, exercised with me, and sat at my elbow during evening consultations, and even took notes. Maybe I can go to job with you, she'd suggested after the first week. You'd be bored there too, I told her, just watching a bunch of women work with numbers all day. Maybe I help. I good with numbers. It turned out she was better than good. She was a whiz at double-entry bookkeeping. She was also good at scheduling, filing, and, if given a script to read from, telephone etiquette. Our supervisors raised skeptical eyebrows at first, but soon enough they were happy to bring in another desk for Jingjing. How'd you ever learn all this stuff? I asked one night when we were alone in our cell. We often talked after lights out, as the clamor faded up and down the pod, and the snow fell softly outside our window. "Promise not tell?" Jing Jing whispered from her top bunk. "Of course I won't tell. 'Cause could be big trouble if cops find out." "Tell you what," I said, "toss me down a Snickers." "Okay." Jing Jing sounded skeptical, but a candy bar landed on my blanket. "Now you've paid me a retainer, and I'm your lawyer, and you're my client, and anything you tell me is privileged." What this mean, privileged? It means it's a secret I can never tell anybody without your consent. "Oh, good deal," she said. For the first several years of her captivity, she told me, she was strictly a sex worker, confined to a small room where she turned as many as 20 tricks a day. But gradually, she was able to impress the bosses through her facility with numbers. She'd work out the day's tally in her head and tell them her estimate, and it would be close enough to the actual take that the bosses decided to move her up front when none of them could be there to run the register. A guard was always stationed at the door, but he was muscle, not brains. So Jing Jing was the one who greeted the Johns as they came in, told them the menu of services and the fee for each, and took their money before directing them to a room. The bosses were pleased. She freed them up to do the important work of finding more girls for their operation. She seldom had to turn a trick again. "So that mean I a pimp too?" she asked. "No," I assured her, "you don't need to worry. Even if the cops knew, they wouldn't charge you. You were still in captivity, and the bosses were still making money off you." Jing Jing hesitated. "But what if I make money too? How?" Her whisper grew even fainter. "The men, they come in and ask how much for handjob, yes? And it 20 bucks, right? But sometimes I tell them 40. I know which ones will pay. The ones who come in already hard, they want backroom bad. They not say no."
"Then you only turned over $20 to the bosses?"
"Yes."
"And the extra 20?
"I have special hiding place. Then special friend, he come get it and put in bank for me." Her whisper went deep and husky. "I have $20,000 in bank."
"Wow," I said.
Then,
"You trust this guy?"
"Oh, sure. He crazy for me."
"Then why doesn't he pay your bail and get you out of here?"
"I tell him not to. Boss men come after me if they think I testify against them. I safer here than out there."
"Jing Jing," I said after a moment, "you're the smartest person I've ever known."
An appreciative giggle sounded from the top bunk.
"But this boyfriend," I said, "how'd you ever meet him?"
Jing Jing's head popped over the edge of her bunk, and she gave me a disdainful look.
"How you think?"
It was 6 weeks before I received any mail at Valhalla. It arrived in a thick manila envelope that had already been opened and clumsily resealed with cellophane tape. My name and the Valhalla address were printed on the front. I didn't recognize the handwriting, but the return address was my own street in the Bronx, so it had to be from David. I carried the envelope back to my cell, ripped off the tape, and shook out the contents. They landed in a heap on my bunk, and I stared at them. All my letters to David.
"Is bad news?" Jing Jing asked, watching my face.
"He returned all my letters."
"Prick," she said.
"No, wait." I sorted through the envelopes. One of them wasn't addressed to David. It was addressed to me, in the same handwriting that was on the outer envelope. Inside was an itemized bill for the last month's rent and the damages to the apartment in excess of our security deposit. Also enclosed was a copy of the eviction notice, dated March 2nd.
"It's not from David," I said. "It's from our landlord."
"So David know a prick?"
"I'm not sure. He couldn't have received any of my letters that arrived after the eviction, but I wondered about before. Whether he just left them unopened on the floor for the landlord to find and forward. or whether he was already gone before the first letter even arrived. He could have moved out the same day I was arrested.
Jingjing picked up the eviction notice.
So where he live now?
I shrugged.
And what he use for money?
She really was the smartest person I knew. She'd homed in on the biggest question of all.
That afternoon, we were both summoned to the attorney consultation room at the same time, me to see my PD and Jingjing to see the ADA.
You okay on your own? I asked her as we entered the room.
Harold Watkins was at one table. The ADA was at another one across the room.
I can blow this guy off if you want me to come with you.
No, you go talk to Mr. Lardo. I handle Ms. Bitch just fine.
She peeled off, and I sat down across from Watkins.
I have news.
A smug smile creased his fleshy jowls.
We lost the expert funding motion.
His announcement barely registered. I never expected to win that motion. That wasn't the point.
I have news too, I said. I slapped the eviction notice down on the table in front of him.
It would have been posted on the door. Your people would have seen it there.
Watkins frowned at the paper.
All they told me was nobody was home.
They never even went, I hissed.
He had the good grace to redden.
I'll look into it, okay?
Have you filed a motion for the release of my briefcase?
There's no real point.
Here. I slapped another paper on the table. I drafted it for you. File it.
Listen.
He folded his hands on the table and leaned forward.
They blinked. They want a deal.
I stared at the flesh of his ring finger where it swelled out around his wedding band. His other fingers were pink, but that one was white. The ring was cutting off the blood supply. He was heading for an amputation.
No deal, I said. I told you.
There's a lot of sympathy building for you out there. People understand what it's like to be trapped in an elevator. On top of everything else you had going on, anybody could flip out. The DA is willing to take all that into consideration.
Tell them to consider this, I said. I hadn't been fired. The video was doctored, and the resume was planted.
He sighed a blast of air that could have come from a blacksmith's bellows.
The company framed you, you're saying.
Yes, I've been saying it all along.
They went to all that trouble just to cover up a suicide.
He rolled his eyes. They have their reasons, reasons that have nothing to do with me.
He threw his fleshy hands into the air.
Then tell me what they are.
File the motion. Get my briefcase back. Find David. Then I'll be happy to tell you, the DA, and everybody else.
I stood up and looked around for Jingjing, but she'd already left the room.
You need to get that cut off, I said to Watkins.
What?
I pointed to his wedding ring, and he was still staring at it as I left. My own wedding ring was bagged up with my street clothes in the jail lockup. But throughout my afternoon work shift, I could feel it squeeze around my finger, like the phantom pain of an amputee. I stabbed at the keys on my computer in hot frustration. I'd been incarcerated for 6 weeks, and none of my get-out-of-jail-free strategies was working. If David couldn't be found, I couldn't prove that the stack of resumes had been planted. My motion for expert funding had been denied, but more to the point, it hadn't triggered the ADA to look more closely at CDMI's video footage. This was the course I'd fixed on from the moment I realized my credibility was shot. They weren't going to believe anything I told them outright, so I would drop hints for them to pick up. If they thought they'd stumbled on the truth on their own, they'd believe it. But they weren't picking up on anything. My strategy wasn't working. I shut down the computer at the end of my shift. Jingjing had never returned to her desk that afternoon. And when I trudged back to our cell, she wasn't there either. My letters to David were still strewn across my bunk. I stared at them, wondering where Jingjing was, wondering where David was, my thoughts spinning furious somersaults, until I finally threw myself down on my bed. I buried my face in the envelopes until the ink ran with my tears. I didn't hear Jingjing return, but I felt her arms around me and heard her voice crooning softly. "I miss you too, big time, but we still be friends. I write you letters every day." I rolled over and looked up at her. "What are you talking about?" "I tell you my phone number and you call me. We talk same as here." I wiped my tears. My hands came away streaked with blue ink. "You're leaving?" It took me a few minutes to pull the story from her and piece it all together. The government had decided that Jingjing's testimony would not be necessary at the trafficker's trials. Her material witness order was vacated, and she was free to go, with the government's gratitude. "But what about ICE? My boyfriend already coming to get me. I be gone before ICE know I free. What about the boss men?" She grinned. "I no worry no more." It seemed that the government had filed its witness list, and Jingjing's name wasn't on it. She wasn't a threat to the traffickers anymore. She was only a missing asset, and she intended to stay missing. "I worry only for you, my friend," she said sadly. Every time I thought I'd reached the bottom of my life trajectory, something came along to remind me I could fall further. Now here I was, being pitied by a one-time sex slave. I forced a smile. "Don't you worry about me," I said, and gave her a farewell hug before I got up to help her pack her things.
Chapter 22. Barrett was on a call with the auditors debating materiality and exactly which of the company's potential liabilities had to be disclosed. Since the dust had settled from the elevator incident, that was how he was able to categorize it now, as an incident. He had time for the more mundane tasks of his position. He'd even been able to schedule a getaway with his children. They'd each been agitating for some dad time, as they called it. And while they wanted it to be one-on-one, there was no way he could manage four separate getaways. Instead, they'd all be spending the next 7 days together. It would be the first time since the divorce. He was pushing back against the bean counters and their insistence on red-flagging every little nuisance claim when Ma Bell chimed an alert on his desktop. He received dozens of these every day, and he gave the screen barely a glance. It was only a new filing on one of the dozens of civil case dockets he monitored. Then he looked again. This one was a new filing in a criminal docket. State v. Lambert. The case had been quiet for weeks, and with Lambert safely out of sight in the county jail, he'd allowed her to fade out of mind, too. But when he logged onto the public access website, he saw that her public defender had filed a motion for the release of her briefcase from the police evidence lockup. It contained documents that were in no way relevant to the charges she faced, the motion argued, but were valuable to her. The motion didn't say what those documents were. He ran through the possibilities. She'd been in the office all day that Sunday, but she hadn't been in the document room. And anyway, Lester Willard was certain she'd never removed a single piece of paper from those files. It was probably nothing. Collection letters from her many creditors, probably. Or poetry she wrote on the train. Still. "Let's pick this up tomorrow," he told the auditors, and disconnected. "Marcia, get Culligan up here," he shouted to the ceiling.
"Right away, Mr. Barrett."
"No, wait. Tell him to meet me in tech in 5 minutes, with the video."
"What video shall I tell him?"
"He'll know." Culligan arrived 5 minutes late, his face a moist pink. "What's up?" he puffed. Barrett looked around the room. A half dozen young men sat at computer stations, staring at their screens, but probably listening to every word he said. "Which one's your guy?" "Jason," Culligan said, and snapped his fingers. A bald kid in tight pants and high-top sneakers jumped up to join them. Barrett drew them into a huddle and explained in a whisper.
We need to look at the footage from that night and see what she put in her briefcase before she left here.
Culligan scratched his chin.
I doubt that'll show up.
It might, the tech kid said. He went back to his terminal and inserted the thumb drive Culligan handed him. Barrett leaned in to watch the screen as the file loaded and the playback began. Culligan leaned in too, and Barrett caught a whiff of scotch. It was only 11 o'clock.
There, the kid said.
He paused on an image through the open door of Shay Lambert's office. She was standing at her desk and sliding some papers into the shabby canvas bag she called her briefcase. Barrett squinted at the screen. Those had to be the papers she wanted back, the ones that were supposedly valuable to her. He couldn't tell what they were. Can you blow this up?
Let's see, the kid hummed.
He switched screens, hit some buttons, then switched back to the first screen.
There.
Barrett leaned in again. In a freeze frame on the screen was a close-up of the stack of documents in Lambert's hand. The top page looked like a printed or typewritten form, but the text was too blurred to read.
See, it's no use, Culligan said.
Barrett pushed the kid out of the way and put his face close to the screen. There was a post-it stuck to the top page, and he just could make out the handwritten notation there. All male employees. What the? He cut himself off as the logo at the top of the printed form came into focus. At first glance, he thought it was the company's white dove. But no, it was a different bird. And with a jolt, he realized it was a Siamese fireback, the national bird of Thailand.
Oh, fuck, he hissed. What?
Look. Culligan leaned in.
The bird?
It's the logo of APU Transport. Culligan turned to stare at Barrett.
She has the charter contracts?
She knows.
Maybe she doesn't know,
Culligan said when they were back in Barrett's office.
I mean, these flights could have been anything. Of course she knows, Barrett snarled.
This was his own fucking fault for hiring someone with her smarts. It wasn't even like the job required it. A good paralegal could have handled that document production. It was his own form of self-aggrandizement to always have the best and the brightest reporting to him. A stupid habit, and potentially self-destructive. Why else would she have smuggled the documents out of the goddamn building? That reminded him. This was actually Culligan's fault.
How the fuck did you let this happen?
You were supposed to have a system in place. She wasn't supposed to take any documents out of the room.
She didn't. These documents were never in the room.
Barrett got up into the man's face. The smell of scotch was now mixed with the stink of nervous sweat.
Well, she didn't get them out of thin air.
Culligan's glistening brow furrowed.
She could have seen a reference to APU in the accounts payable. Then, I don't know. She did some digging on her own. I don't know, Barrett jeered. I fucking pay you to know. I'll go and see her. I'll find out what she knows. You do that, Jack.
He stabbed a finger into Culligan's chest.
And you better hope the answer is nothing.
The man swallowed hard.
And if it isn't, then we'll have no choice.
We'll have to bail her out. Culligan's eyes went wide. He ducked his head and hurried out of the room.